to No Filter. I'm Eli Zarrett, the host of this new podcast, one of about 100 million podcasts in America. This is the most fascinating new media where someday everybody in America is going to have his own podcast with about three listeners, and there'll be about 10 of them that do really, really well, like Joe Rogan here in Detroit, Mike and Drew, or Drew and Mike, whatever. And hopefully we'll get a few listeners for this one. We did pretty well for the one that Denny McClain and I were on a few weeks ago, and I'm back with Denny today, and a special guest. Maybe if you thought Denny and I were opinionated back in the day when we did our show, and we were, this guy, I think, tops us all because he truly has no filter, and that's Bob Page I'm talking about. Bob, give us a little bit of history. You worked with Al Ackerman. Denny, shut your goddamn phone off, as I asked you to do a little while ago. I got him to stop eating.
You can swear on a podcast.
I got him to stop eating, but I forgot to tell him about the phone.
Well, first of all, it's wonderful to be here with two living dinosaurs, with two living legends in Detroit. And I think if you care enough to be listening to this right now, I think you know something about me and my background. You know, I came down to Detroit from Channel 6 in Lansing, and I went to work for WJR. I got fired there for telling the truth about the Lions and so on and so forth. I worked at Channel 7, and then I left the TV show with Ron Cameron. And
no, that was fun.
WRF, yeah, yeah, fun and funny.
And one of the most dysfunctional human beings in ever. The history of the race,
and
but still.
And yeah, he's still doing radio and TV 50 years later.
You know what? Dick Vitale told me something years ago about Cameron. He said, by rights, this guy should be lying in a gutter in Detroit with a needle stuck in his arm. You better respect what he's been able to do for himself. You heard about high school dropouts? He never attended one day of high school.
His mother
kicked him out of the house when he was 15. Never had a father. His mother said, I've had enough of you. You know, I'm busy with my life, whatever. Kicked him out of the house at 15. And this little waif, you know, would hang out outside the back door of the Olympia, you know, waiting for his idols, his heroes to come out. And so Gordy and Alex and, you know, Gads and all those guys, you know, what's this boy doing out here alone? Son, don't you have a home? No, I actually don't. And they took him under their collective arms. And
the hockey guys loved him.
It's amazing.
I mean, especially the older generation, they loved him. When we used to go down and do some interviews before the show was being shot every week, they would come out and go to him and shake his hand. They'd come right over to him. Gordie Howe.
We're talking about Ron Cameron. We have to cut this short because I don't think a lot of people know who Ron Cameron is.
In this market in Detroit? Because you have listeners everywhere, I guess.
Minimum age. 50 to know about Ron.
I disagree with you. Everybody, it seems to me, almost every show I do, not necessarily out of Michigan, but every show I do in Michigan, I hear, hey, do you still do your show with Ron Cameron? Right. But that's not encouraging to know that you are doing a show with him and nobody, everybody asks. But it is a miracle what he's accomplished in 50 years. It really is. And if you go have lunch with him tomorrow, first of all, he'll never buy. But number two, he's got a roll of checks and cash in his pocket that make the biggest drug dealer in town greedy and selfish.
Stories you got about Cameron, I can top them.
I know you can.
Save him.
Everyone.
Speaking of dysfunction,
You asked about the rest, and I moved to New York in 1988, and I worked nationally and regionally in New York a long time. I'm retired. I still live in Manhattan, and I have a place in West Palm Beach and come back to my hometown three times a year.
Bob's the biggest media gig besides being in Detroit, working at Channel 7 with Al Ackerman and WJR, back with the legendary Bob Reynolds. Don't get me started. Bob did a show. Did a show on the MSG network in New York. For 10 years. It was the nighttime wrap-up. He went on in between periods. It was a very, very big show in New York. Became very well-known. Problem is, you continually criticize the teams that were paying him, the Rangers and Knicks.
The teams weren't paying me. They thought that they should have influence over our Madison Square Garden network, which was independent. And it got back to me. It used to get back to me that Steinbrenner would call our boss, Bob Gutkowski, off. And Gutkowski would sit there, listen to George Steinbrenner, and say, how can you let Page say the stuff on the air that he's saying about this? And Gutkowski said, George, we paid you $500 million for the Yankees' rights. You run the ball club. I run the network.
Which is exactly what Nike told the NFL. We pay you big money. CBS or NBC took our money. Shut the hell up. The Colin Kaepernick spot is running, and I got him in front of an American flag. Was the best shot in that thing. Kaepernick proudly look at the American flag. Who's the patriot? Who isn't the patriot? Anyway, let's not get on that. I want to get.
Well, that's an hour and a half discussion alone right there. And it's, everybody's beating it to death.
So obviously the Lions, for whatever reason, no matter how they do, and usually poorly, there is an emotional connection with this team. And maybe it's because they only have 16 games. Maybe it's the NFL. But one game, you know, like the Tigers season now is basically over, so nobody cares. There's no real emotion, kind of apathy. With the Lions, you either love them, you're excited, or you hate them to death. And to see what happened after one game is very ominous, because not only did they not play for Patricia, Patricia doesn't even look like a coach. He makes Denny look like a svelte Kenyan marathon runner with his physique. And the hat on backwards, the scruffy beard, the pencil, he looked like some schlub, to use a New York phrase, standing on the sidelines.
Let me add one thing. Wouldn't you, as the new coach in a new town with all new opportunity, wouldn't you want to perk up a little bit? Wouldn't you want to make yourself look like a real coach? Maybe a shirt and tie once in a while?
This guy's got, you're talking about a guy who's got, what, 4 or 5 Super Bowl rings? Is that what you're talking about? Guy's got 4 or 5 Super Bowl rings?
As an assistant coach, which means nothing.
Defensive coordinator the last number of years under Belichick. This guy has been a great football coach. And, of course, in this market, because of the FLs, I'm sorry, you know, I always call them the FLs. And, you know, everybody knows what the F stands for. I guess I can't say it on the radio. But everybody in this market, you know, now their patience is wearing thin, and they're going nuts. I'm listening to some of the kids on Talk Sports Radio the other day on Tuesday afternoon. There's, we knew Patricia would never work out.
That's right.
We knew he couldn't get. It's one game, my God.
Right.
Let's face it. There's a pathology with sports fans in general. I think the media has something to do with it. They make long-term conclusions over short-term results. So you start like this, and in everybody's mind, unless those who are more fair-minded and realize it's a long season. And also, let's note that what happens a lot in the NFL, when you lose 1 week, everybody bets against you because they think you suck. You come back the next week and you win big. A lot of people are listening to this show after they play the 49ers on Sunday. So you make these long-term conclusions over short-term results. But this was pretty one-sided with nothing positive to take out of it. Is it illusion? Is it reality? We don't know.
We do know it's the FLs, and they will never, ever, ever even get to a Super Bowl as long as the idiot, bungling Ford family owns that franchise.
See, that's unkind.
But it's the truth.
I take exception.
But it's the truth.
Listen, all the Fords have done is put up their money for 1,000 years here and take a beating every year. Money, and they make money. Don't misunderstand me. I don't care if they, whatever they do, how they do it.
That's just what they need, money. That's just what the Fords need.
But the point is, they've kept a team here. Anybody who would probably want to come in here, if in fact they want to come in here, would probably consider moving the ball club.
You're not moving the Detroit Lions. You're not moving the Detroit Lions. You're not moving the New York Giants. You're not moving the Detroit Lions.
You would never leave this town with this support after 61 straight years of nothing. Right. And they sell out that dome. People are the greatest shot was two fans I saw on YouTube or something, with both with Lion jerseys, punching each other out in the stands.
Yeah,
so I anticipate what happened was, one guy says, you suck, I'm sick of my seat, blah, blah, blah. The other guy says, hey, don't quit on them so soon. You get two Lions fans beating each other up as they're going down like a bunch of pansies on the field.
That's the problem with the Lions games, why you can't take your family down there. In the second half, the pathology has totally changed.
Totally.
Now you've got every wrestler and kickboxer in the country fighting in the stands.
They
don't do anything about
Danny, it. Danny, I'm telling you, I took my young wife 100 years ago down to a Lions game. We had no money. We bought a couple $9 seats, sit in the stands. We sat right behind about 4 World War II type guys. And, of course, they were just drunk. They were obnoxious. I finally told – I'm a kid, you know. I'm like whatever I was. I told the guy, hey, you keep it down. Stop with the profanity. Or I was sitting here with my wife and everything like that. We stopped that. It's always been – there have always been drunks, and it's always been bad. And I want to say another thing about what you just said to me as a rejoinder, and that is this. It was little Billy Ford who took control of the Lions in 1962.
Four, I believe it was.
All right, whatever. Okay, yeah. And he installed Russ Thomas And the story, I know you know the story.
We know the story there.
Yep, that he felt that Russ Thomas saved him from alcoholism and perhaps even dying of alcohol poisoning one night. And Russ Thomas, one of the most evil Machiavellian characters in the history of this town, ran that franchise into the ground after they had been the greatest franchise in pro football throughout the 1950s. And Ford remained steadfastly loyal to him the entire time. Those guys stole our football team. They stole it, and they thumbed their noses at us. Every stupid draft choice, everything they did. And then, of course, we had Matt Millen. Fortunately, I was long gone. Same thing with Matt Millen. So it's about the Ford family and the Ford ownership. A franchise that has as its CEO a 92-year-old woman and is being run by her, what, 60-something daughters?
Yeah.
It's insanity. But it's the NFL's.
The NFL has always been a little backwards from time to time. This organization, ever since I've been a fan, and that's when we first got here in 63, it's been backwards every day I've been here. I mean, they just don't perform at any level of competition. They just don't. And if they have a chance to win a ball game, they always, it seems to me, 99.9%, they blow it every time. I mean, we've been talking about the quarterback, right? Everybody in the world has been talking about our quarterback. When the hell is he going to be the star that everybody predicts? He's making $100 million, and the kid the other night looked like a $10 quarterback.
You don't think they got their money's worth out of him against the Jets?
Not all of it. Maybe a little bit.
Well, I think
he's become the face of the Lions to some degrees in all the commercials now. He's doing all kinds of things.
He's fine, and
I think he's had twin girls on purpose, I think. I don't know how you do that, but in my next life, I'm going to do that. But no, I just believe it's been, they're looking for something other than winning football games. I really believe that. I don't think they're in it for winning and losing.
I think the Fords are in it for
perception.
I've always thought the Ford.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean they don't want to win. I think William Clay Ford wanted
winning
to very,
is
very
way
bad.
On back burner.
But it's it, no. There's two sides.
Otherwise, they'd have gone out and signed a quarterback a long time ago.
First of all, you need to have. This is simplistic, I know, but
I'm talking to a guy who can't putt the ball from 3 feet. He's telling us about professional sports
in pro football.
Dear Lord,
you need
Jesus
to have
help
a genius
me.
Somewhere.
Yes,
it has
you do.
To be the owner. Maybe a Jerry Jones is a genius. Maybe Kraft is a genius. You need a genius as a head coach or a genius general manager. They've never had anybody in that position. And I take it back to what Bob said. You're right. Russ Thomas destroyed that team in the 60s. He lost Ron Jesse, one of the first free agents, a fine wide receiver, because over $1,000. $1,000. He went to the. He offered him 22. He wanted 22 grand. Russ stopped at 21 and lost him for that. Lem Barney's rookie contract, 16, 17, 18,000. They never renegotiated. They never gave him a bonus. Russ Thomas was a cheapskate.
And whom did they draft? They drafted Fred Biletnikoff. They drafted John Hadle. All those guys said, they're not signing with the AFL. We're the Detroit Lions. Russ Thomas and Billy Ford. And you can go on and on about this stuff. It's enough to drive you crazy. I kicked the habit years ago when I went to New York in 1988. Wellington Mara himself and the New York Giants welcomed me with open arms.
Did he really?
It was one of the classiest. That was an unknown guy from Detroit coming in. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And they were so nice to me. The Jets were a little different, but. Yeah. I watch every Giants game. I watch every Jets game. And I was telling people I can't decide what made me happier. I was at the game Monday night wearing my Jets T-shirt. What made me happier? The FL's miserable, humiliating loss or the fact that the Jets played so well. But I was real happy about both.
I think anybody would have played well Monday night against us. We had no defense. We had certainly no offense. I mean, I wonder, was there a player on the field the other night? It looked like after the first period when they really didn't get out of the box very well, it looked like they'd given up.
So why does this happen?
By the end of the third quarter, because they don't demand anything. If you can't demand of your players, the ownership does not demand what they should be demanding.
Oh, I don't know about
that. If you demand out of a guy, you're giving him $100,000, $2 million, $5 million, $20 million, you should be getting something back for the money. We get very little back for the money. the money here. We don't get the money back. Who is producing at a level that they're worth the money that they're getting?
Well, come on. They've had some decent years. Jim Caldwell had a winning record, took them to the playoffs 1 year. I think, weren't they 10-6 last year? So it isn't that the players don't play hard. Let's not take all the passes.
You guys are going to fall over
when
I tell you.
What is happening right now, though?
I'll tell you what the mistake they made, and you guys are going to fall right over when I tell you this. Okay, there was a guy by the name of Wayne Fonseer, who was a hell of a guy.
Cocaine Wayne.
It's okay. That's all right.
I was not going to use the cocaine. It's just the police found it in my car.
We're not going to get into the character issues here. Yeah, he's talking about him as a coach.
But I'm telling you, as a coach, the players loved him. Yes. They played as hard as they could for any coach I've ever seen. They loved him. They respected him. They may have shared things together for all I know. But the bottom line is, I thought that was a mistake when they let him go. He had just got a group of people who really wanted to play and be here.
I think he'd been here long enough. And in fact,
of course, but they loved him at this point in time. Why get rid of him then?
Well, okay.
Buy him a pharmacy.
I think it was because of the arrest where he was busted with cocaine. You can't have that.
But wait a minute. We got a coach right now that's been accused of rape or something
Nonsense.
It must be pretty serious. Right. Serious police report's been filed.
You guys are talking about players and coaches for the FLs. I want to get it back to where it belongs. Owners. We got, in this town, we got guys like Roger Penske. We got guys like Dan Gilbert. We got a lot of people out there with big bucks and who've already owned sports franchises. Please, Dan, buy the Lions, Dan. Please buy the Lions. When I worked with Al Ackerman 40 years ago on Channel 7, Al would end frequently his broadcast. He looked right in the camera and say, "Mr. Ford, sell the team." And they just wouldn't do it, and the Ford family won't do it. And until they do, that's what you're going to get.
Well, I got a little scoop for you. I found out the other day from somebody really reputable that Tigers are trying to sell the ball club.
I hear that too. But you know what? I'll say this, though.
I know the group.
I've heard that. But if you watch the game on – well, I guess I better not date this too much. If you watch the game, the afternoon game Wednesday, the season the series – against the Astros, they actually interviewed Chris Illich, and they put on what he's talking about the team. And Chris Illich said, I love running the Tigers. I was such a big fan when I was a kid growing up, and I'm having a blast, and we're going to get better. That doesn't sound like a guy to me like who's thinking, yeah, maybe we might sell the team.
Well, that could be. Also, we know that Mike wanted the team. Marion didn't want the team. The kids are really more into hockey, and it's a very tough sport to run. Very, very difficult.
Hockey. That's what they love their hockey team.
Yeah.
I mean, look at all the money they put in the hockey team with while baseball was suffering there for a while. Now it flipped around, and now it's a better organization. But right now, we've got a pig and a poke over there.
Well, let's button up the Lions here. So, wait and see with Matt Patricia, or did we see enough in game one to realize?
That's just what I said. One game. You think Matt Stafford's going to play this bad at San Francisco? I don't think so either. In San Francisco, not too good. So
the optics were just real, real bad. I mean, you wait 8 months to play a game. You get all, and this is the pathology of fans. The draft, they call the talk shows, they care, they're ready. It's opening night, and they lay an egg
crazy.
Like this. And so Lion fans just get raked over the coals. They get dumped into the abyss. They get angry, but never apathy. Apathy over the Pistons, nobody cares. Red Wings have apathy setting in. Tigers may have apathy for some reason. The Lions still sell out that ballpark, and people still care, no matter how much
they sell out for one reason. They only play 16 games, 8 at home. I mean, come on.
Which is why one game also seems so much
worse. Well, my thing is this. If you look at the composition of the crowd, you're going to see a lot of – most people are 40 and under. And I sometimes talk to these young people, and I say, can I ask you just one question? I said, sure. Who was Russ Thomas? They've never
heard
the name. So they're not going back to when Billy Ford got control of the Lions. This is not part of their history. So all they think is, well, we got rid of Matt Millen. Now we're going to win. No, you're not. My thing is, and it's obviously an arbitrary thing with respect to age. If you're from Detroit and you're over the age of 55 and you're still rooting for these clowns, you got a problem. you got a problem.
It's the only football game in town.
Well, what do you want him to do? Go root for somebody else?
Ackerman and I had a contest 40 years ago again on Channel 7 in which we had an adopt team. There's a pillar of truthfulness. Dallas. And, of course, everybody wanted to adopt Dallas.
But there's, you're bringing up the pillar of truthfulness.
Oh, yeah, right. You and Al had some problems.
He is a junior Donald Trump. I'm sorry.
I worked with the guy for 2.5 years, and it was very, very difficult at times.
God. Me too. I worked for him. And we had when I replaced him on the 11 o'clock news in June 1984, was really, really ugly.
I replaced a guy in New York on a radio show. His name was Howard Cohen. He had been an attorney out of Eastern Parkway, Brooklyn, New York, until he changed his last name to Cosell. So Cosell, I took one of his shows before they gave me both of his shows. He went to our boss, Shelby Whitfield.
Oh, my God, Shelby.
You know Shelby, yeah.
From Washington. Fired me. He only fired me once.
From the Washington Senators.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, of course. So he goes to Shelby Whitfield and says, I saw your man Page on television again last night. He has no talent. Why is he with our company? Shelby says, now, Howard, you can say what you want to about Bob, but you can't say he doesn't have any talent. He has no talent. But Howard, Bob says that you're like one of the biggest influences on his career. Oh, yeah? What career is that?
We're talking with Bob Page, a longtime Detroit sportscaster, at least until the late 80s, and then MSG in New York, and he's back in town on a visit, and Denny and I are visiting with him. Well, we've kind of taken, by being even-handed, which is a credit to all of us, to take a longer look at Matt Patricia, where we're not going to jump to conclusions and do what fans do, which is tear your hair out. But how about the Jimmy Harbaugh question? This one is, by the way, before I put Patricia away, people ask me, well, how do you think he'll do? I go, I don't know. He's an assistant coach. Marty Mordegweg was an assistant coach. We're all excited about him. But it's a big leap between being an assistant and being a head coach. All types of leadership, organization, getting people to work under you, a very, very different role. And Rod Marinelli was a great coordinator and assistant. And what he was 0-16. And so was Jim Schwartz. It was great. And so was, I'm trying to think, there's one more in there.
Okay, start naming the great coaches in the National Football
League. All were assistants at one time. Just because you were and worked under Belichick doesn't mean anything when it comes to having the head.
That's true.
And the great coaches always have the ability, not only game planning, ball games all the time, but they also have the unique ability, but drawing enough people around them, hiring enough people around them that know the game better than somebody else does. All you got to do is look at the Patriots.
Right.
They thus have geniuses over there. Forget the IT and all that other stuff. They've got people who know the game better than most people.
Of course, the main thing is they had a genius, a complete genius, who drafted Tom Brady in, the fifth round of the NFL selections. That's real genius. That's Tom Brady of Michigan.
But you know what?
They just got so lucky with that.
But somebody saw something.
Yeah.
That's all. Somebody saw something. Right. Maybe he didn't get the opportunity at Michigan he should have had.
And they knew they could get him in the sixth round, so they got somebody good in the fifth round, so... You never quite know how that works, but Harbaugh is really another story. I mean, we were all.
I want to hear what you're going to say about Harbaugh. You went to Michigan. Go ahead. I want to hear this.
I think the results speak for themselves. He's not a genius. He's not a savior. He's dealing with an even playing field here in the Big Ten. He competes all over the country. He's got no leg up on anybody, and so far he has proved nothing. Only that. He's proved that he's not the genius that we thought he was. We've proved that he is merely mortal, and a lot of the hype and a lot of the showmanship and a lot of the grandstanding all over now, because why can't he get the mobile quarterback that beats Michigan every time? The JT Barrett, the Wimbush, all the and he gets these Shea Patterson can roll out a little bit. Where's the dual threat quarterback that he should have, that he was kind of when he played? Why can't he find them? Instead, all he gets is guys that somebody else took, which is the Mississippi State guy, Patterson. Jake Rudock was decent, but he was somebody else's quarterback.
Iowa.
He can't find his own.
Yeah. What star in college football or high school football would not want to play for Jim Harbaugh? He's won everything in his life, everything. Mm-hmm. And now he comes here. And looks like he doesn't even belong in the league.
Well, Denny, here's the thing. I know you're a Michigan State fan, and I actually graduated from Michigan State. I love both Michigan and Michigan State.
My grandkids graduated from Michigan State, though.
If you look at the history over the last 10 or 15 years with Mark D'Antonio at State, They can't recruit with Michigan or Ohio State or Notre Dame. They take these two-star kids, those are the guys they can get, and they coach them up, and they become stars. Yeah. You look at, it's not just Jimmy. You go back before that to Brady Hoke. You can go to Rich Rod, obviously. Michigan is always recruiting these five-star kids from all over America, and most of them just never seem to develop.
Never quite get
there. Michigan State takes these unknown kids, and they develop into All-Americans, Le'Veon Bell, you know, and big stars, Kirk Cousins. Those were two-star players. Le'Veon Bell's from Columbus. Yeah. Columbus. Urban didn't want him.
There's another dynamic, and that is that it's been 10 years now with Rich Rodriguez and Brady Hoke and now Harbaugh, where Michigan has been like Iowa, as Braylon Edwards said, a middle-of-the-pack team, nothing special. It's a talent pool. I tell people, I never met a Buckeye I didn't like. I may hate them when Michigan plays them, but it's a talent pool. Chris Spielman wanted to come here. His dad wouldn't let him, whatever. So you go where you think you can play. So the point I'm making is Harbaugh has no advantage over anybody anymore. And it's just as cold in Ann Arbor as it is in East Lansing. And you look around the country, and if a kid wants to play, he says, where can I play? Where can I win? Where will I get noticed? And at this point, I don't think Michigan's got anything over anybody else.
Harbaugh has a huge advantage, which is because he's Jimmy, because it's Michigan. This is why they're getting these five-star kids from all over America. They got Ed McCaffrey's kid out on the West Coast, Dylan McCaffrey. They bring him in. The guy's one of the top high school quarterbacks in America.
You're going to get some of
them. Going to Michigan? Is he playing backup quarterback right now? And he just hasn't quite developed. And it seems like so many of these guys, they were telling us that Ruiz, 2 years ago when he came out of high school, Ruiz, the Michigan center, 2 years ago when he came into high school, they're telling us this guy's going to be the next All-American in Michigan. Now, they're just laying into him after what's happened so far, you know, especially in the opening game against Notre Dame. It just seems to me there's a pattern here where they get great players. They don't coach them, I guess, properly.
It's got to be coaching. It has to be coaching. Yeah. It has to be.
Well, point is, they have no advantage over anybody anymore, I don't really think. And Bo Schembechler.
And they wouldn't be getting all these five-star players.
Right, absolutely. I agree with you. You got a resume with a head coach here that's second to none. The guy was a winner, winner, winner. His whole family was a winner. And yet he cannot put a building together now. He just can't do it. And I believe one of the problems is he's a quarterback. Period. That's what he is. He should be coaching a quarterback. That's all. Leave somebody else the football team. Let him start working with the quarterbacks that are supposed to be your talent pool.
And then he'll
develop something.
Right. Remember, he was a pro style drop back quarterback.
Right.
So you asked earlier, how come we don't get these? You asked these dual threat quarterbacks,
right.
You know, who can, because that's not his game. He wants to develop drop back pro type quarterbacks.
And it's doable. We got to find the guy first, and then develop him.
Michigan wouldn't have a problem finding that. They just got to identify him, and they got to recruit him. I mean, did Denard Robinson, you know, have a great, great career at Michigan? Individual stats and everything like that, I suppose. But you know, they still didn't necessarily win with him. My point is just that isn't the answer to everything.
I heard third party testimony, so it's third party testimony. But Don Brown, the defensive coordinator, said in the off season to people that he knows, friends, kind of off the record, that he doesn't even know what's going on offense. He says Pep Hamilton is the passing coach, but he said Drevno is the worst offensive coordinator he's ever seen. Now they have no offensive coordinator. They got an offensive line coach, they got Harbaugh, and they got a passing coach. So nobody even knows who's running the offense anymore.
But don't the football teams, college football teams, especially a program like this, don't they have somebody in the middle of all the coaches, in the middle of all the players that kind of coordinate what's going on? This guy takes the running backs, this guy takes the ends, this guy takes the defensive backs. Don't they have a coordinator like that?
They don't have an offensive coordinator. They don't have it anymore.
They do have an offensive quarterback.
No.
He's the coach.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why he might want to be that. Like, an offensive coordinator is going to know about running an offense.
Bob, I think they're afraid to tread on his territory. Because you come over here, you think Jim Harbaugh is going to be the answer to all questions, right?
Yeah.
You get over here, maybe they're intimidated by him.
Yeah.
Maybe he does not let go of the reins like he needs to.
Right. Now, all this being said, I sent an email around to a lot of guys, including Eli, recently when the depth charts came out to start the season, and I looked at them both because I never miss either a Michigan or Michigan State football game.
Yeah.
I said Michigan's much better on paper than Michigan State is, and I still think that State is overrated, as we know now, and I think there's so much anger and frustration built up in Ann Arbor. I think Michigan's going into East Lansing this year and they're going to kill them. and they're going to kill him.
No kidding.
We'll see.
Wow. Well, and you know, how many years has he got left? 4 or 5?
Oh, Harbaugh? Yeah, at least.
On his contract, though. And the speculation is he's going to quit and go to the NFL after this season. I don't know.
If he can get an NFL job after what he's done here.
This group that was talking to me the other night about somebody buying the Lions, they said, because I asked them, I said, how many years has he got left on his contract with Michigan? As many as he wants.
They'll never fire him. Unless this thing's just deteriorate. Another big name in the news this week, Steve Yzerman. Steps down as general manager of the Tampa Bay Lightning, and he's going to be an advisory role. And so the speculation is he's going to come here and replace Kenny Holland, who has 2 years, I think, left, and will help train Yzerman back when he retired as a player and was an assistant to his. I think that's kind of a stretch on that story. I don't really know. Steve still has a house here. Any thoughts on that?
As I told you yesterday, we were hanging out at the ball game together. I think the situation here is going to be a real conundrum for the Wings. If the club plays well this year and makes the playoffs, and I think they got a chance, then how do you bring Stevie in and buy out the remaining year on Kenny's contract? If the club doesn't play well this year, then it's obvious Blashill's gone and they will bring Yzerman in. But, you know, this could be an interesting problem the Wings have going on. I thought it was really strange myself. I really don't understand it, why Stevie did what he did. You want to come to Detroit? Be the GM this year of Tampa again. Why wouldn't you do that?
Sure, why not?
Well, my theory is this. He takes next year, he is an advisor, and he gets deeper into it. Just like a bad, not a legitimate analogy, but before Joe Dumars became general manager, he spent a year studying how everybody does it, went around the league, talked to people. Maybe Steve was going to travel more. Maybe he's going to do more scouting. Maybe he's going to...
I don't think so. I think he does all that anyway. And remember, he's with Tampa this season as an advisor. Right. I mean, so he's just... So, I just don't understand what he did or why he did it.
But. And maybe he'll take a year off?
No way.
You know, the other thing, too, I mean, as far as advisor this... advisor that, he's going to get the same paperwork everybody else gets. I mean, he doesn't need to leave his home. He's going to get the same stuff. So what the hell is the sense of taking the whole year off, technically, before he comes here?
And remember, he's built that club into one of the top six teams in the National Hockey League.
Hell of a club.
And you remember, they thought their answer to everything was a 6'8 goaltender that they had a couple years ago. Yeah. And then they traded him. They said, what? You traded him? How could you do that? And they found the other goaltenders. You know,
well, he was a great goaltender, up and down. Left and right, he wasn't so good.
Right. And in hockey, you got to cover all corners, all four corners of the net. So,
but it would be great to see Yzerman in town. He has a legacy here. I told you a story the other night that I'm going to repeat now about him. I don't think Denny's heard it. And that is, before Scotty Bowman came here,
I loved Scotty Bowman. Because he was a winner. I just loved Scotty Bowman.
He was an awful interview. He was he was the stone face.
He was Mr.
guy.
Hockey.
He was Mr. Hockey, and he came here and saw a dysfunctional team. They had lost in the first round of the playoffs the year before under Brian Murray, and they fired Brian Murray, and he came in and he had to make them better. Well, the next year they also lost in the first round in the seventh game when Chris Osgood made a poor pass out of the net. The Sharks scored, and again they're knocked out in the first round. Tragedy, the great Scotty Bowman, et cetera, et cetera. But he had observed a dysfunctional locker room, a lot of stars like Paul Coffey, a Hall of Famer, Yzerman, who was the darling of all the coaches. Stevie, whether it's Jacques Demers, whether it's Brad Park, whether it's Harry Neal, they all kissed up to Steve Yzerman because he was the darling, and he scored 55 to 65.
He was the meal ticket.
He was the face of the organization.
Right. And not only that, he was on his way to becoming the second or third all-time leading scorer. So Scotty comes into town, and he takes Steve aside. He says, Steve, 65 goals ain't going to happen anymore, okay? 55 isn't going to happen. You gotta be a real leader and make Chris Draper better. You got to make Garen McCarty better. I need you, and we got this young guy, Sergei Fedorov. He's a scoring machine. You can't be scoring 55 goals. Are you in? Yzerman fought him, was unhappy, only scored 24 goals there in 94, his first season. The season ends. You and I were doing a show together, I think, at the time.
Right.
And I'm working at Channel 2. And the day they clear out...
Wasn't that the lockout shortened year, though? 94-95, they had a lockout start the season right after the Rangers won. Rangers won in 93-94.
Yeah,
that's why he scored 24 goals. I don't know.
This is... Okay. Well, he never scored more than 26 or 27 after that the rest of his career. So Eisman's very upset because he's the star, he's the scorer. And so he fought with Scotty, or he disrespected and thought that Scotty was hurting his career. And that 94 season ended as they cleaned out their lockers. I'm talking to him, right, and he was very discouraged. They'd lost the day before. He'd had a very mediocre season, and he knew that Scotty was in charge and Stevie was no longer the golden boy. Well, you know, and I said, okay, I understand you're not happy. We'll talk about it later. So I watch them carefully over the next few years, and they start bringing in these Russians, and they're starting to win. And Steve is scoring less, but it's an incredibly cohesive team. They score less points, the left wing lock and all that. So they finally win the championship in 97. I think to myself, what is he going to say, knowing what he thought about Scotty at this big celebration at Joe Louis Arena? And he's the last one to speak, and he says, I'd like to thank the Illiches for their great leadership. I'd like to thank the fans, and I'd like to thank, I'm sitting there thinking, what's he saying? I'd like to thank Scotty Bowman, who taught us how to be champions and taught me how to be a great leader. And look what it's done for him. In fact, when you and I, Denny and I, were in Winnipeg that year, and we were backstage before we spoke to this group. Yeah. And the general manager of the Jets was a guy named John Paddock, like a paddock at a stable. And he said,
the coach of the New York Rangers, too. I mean, Paddock
said to Denny and I wouldn't want Eisman on my team. He's a clubhouse lawyer. Don't need that kind of. And we're thinking, holy shit. Yeah. And then Scotty had him traded to the Ottawa Senators. And only Mike Ilitch stepped in and nixed the trade. So he was going to exile Steve, and he got rid of Coffey, got rid of Sean Berg, got rid of all the guys. And he was actually, I think, and somebody told me this, pleased they lost in the first round to the Sharks, because then he got the go-ahead to clean up this clubhouse, get rid of all these, get rid of some stars and make it a great team. You know, give Steve credit. He learned his lessons. He looked in the mirror. He saw that he didn't understand the game to the level Scotty did, and I believe that's got a lot to do with him being a great general manager.
And I will add one other point. During that period of time, I'm getting back to Ron Cameron. you might laugh, but I'm going to tell you something. He said something, because it never appeared to me to be that the Red Wings were at war. I mean, I never saw any war going on when I went in the clubhouse. They were not out of the clubhouse. Lo and behold, Ron Cameron told me, he says, man, I don't know who's going to come out of there with a broken nose or a broken arm. I said, what are you talking about? He says, they got some wars going on in there that you would not believe.
There was the Coffey contingent. There was the Eisman contingent.
Right.
They were both headed to the Hall of Fame. And like you and Lolich, it's tough to have two great players in the same position sometimes.
Yeah. I would just say this about Mike Ilitch, since we're on that subject. This is, as we know, a self-made multi-millionaire / billionaire. He played minor league baseball for a little bit. He busted his ass, and he created an empire. He knows how to win. He knows what he's doing. For one year, 1955, that was the only year William Clay Ford was ever allowed to work for the Ford Motor Company. He was treasure. He was the treasure of the Ford Motor Company. Born with a silver spoon in his mouth, never had to fight for anything, never did anything on his own. That's the difference in ownership, the difference that ownership makes.
If he could have picked the right, and picking Matt Millen was ridiculous. Billy Jr. is probably responsible for it. Remember the opening news conference?
Responsible for Millen not being here anymore. You know that story. I think everybody knows that story.
Responsible for him being here and for not being here. Yeah, responsible. Exactly. And William Clay Ford Jr. introduced Matt Millen that day as a man of towering intelligence. I'd never heard that term, towering intelligence. He was a smart guy, but he made a classic mistake by thinking he was so smart. He hired an assistant coach in Marty Morningweg. He should have hired somebody with experience.
You know, when you well remember this, when women were invading the Lions locker rooms and the players' wives didn't like it, and some of the players didn't like it, they shut down the locker room to us. We could no longer get into the Lions locker room.
Is that right?
They had an anteroom where they brought individual players in, and we had to speak to them in press conference. You get a one-on-one interview afterwards if that's what you wanted. But Bill Ford would stand by that door every day. Nicest guy you'll ever meet. Hey, Mr. Ford, how are you today? Hey, Bob, how's it going? Everybody says, thanks, Mr. Ford. Everything's going fine. Too big, a tough loss today, so on and so forth. And then I left for New York in 88. And as the years went on, I found that Bill Ford had become essentially a recluse. He didn't do interviews anymore. He didn't come out and talk to anybody more. He was so humiliated by what was going on at the media treatment and stuff. He became a changed man. Skinny yeah. changed, man.
I got to tell you one quick 30-second story. I was at some kind of a cocktail party, late 60s, early 70s, and 69 had just ended. And so I had five pretty good years in a row, and I ran into Russ Thomas. Mr. Ford was in the building also at this cocktail party. And Russ Thomas walked up to me and says, can I talk to you for a second? And I said, sure, nice to meet you. I'd never met him before. And we talked for 5 or 10 minutes. He says, by the way, he says, Mr. Ford keeps thinking that you could be a quarterback.
Well, last topic.
I'll just add, since you mentioned him again in this in this context, he would also stand at the door. And so, he was huge. He was a big tackle at Ohio State. Yeah. And I remember one day he's standing at that door after a game. And I walk.
Russ Snell?
Russ Thomas. Yeah. And I walk out the door to go do whatever I was going to do. We don't speak to each other, obviously. He speaks to me for the first time in years. He goes like this. I see the cheap shot bullshit you guys are taking at me all the time on that goddamn television show. I stopped. I said, Russ, I will cancel any guest. You can come on our television show anytime you want to and defend your role as general manager of the Lions.
We tried too.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we'll put the Lions aside for a second. You were saying something earlier, Denny, that I thought was interesting, and that is the change in
analyzation.
Which started with Sabermetrics, the Bill James Sabermetrics back in the late 90s or late 80s or mid 80s, whenever the hell it was, looking at different stats in baseball. And it's become such a mathematical game. Certainly promoted well by Moneyball, the whole Billy Bean story.
But that's not – the Billy Bean story is such a bullshit story. Let me tell you something about that story. Billy Bean did not invent – what they think he invented, you know, the sabermetrics and putting everybody for the shift, the Ted Williams. The shift itself, the shift in general, was invented by my father-in-law, Lou Boudreau. He's the one that took that entire infield and put it on the right side of the ballpark. Ted Williams.
Yeah.
That's where they started coming up with all these ideas. And a lot of teams tried it over the years. They just never had any success because nobody was writing down the results. And that's what Lou was to say. So all they got to do is write the results down. They'll know where the guy hits the ball 80% right. of the time. So my point is I hear all this Billy Bean bullshit. And Billy's a nice guy. Don't misunderstand me. But, man, you talk about guys getting credit for something they had nothing to do with, literally nothing to do with. And then, of course, now you can put it on a laptop, put it on anything you want to put it on, your wristwatch, for God's sakes. And it just irritates the hell out of me. Now they've got something in all 30 ballparks. They call it Pitching FX. It's in all stadiums. It's been in there since 2006, by the way. And this is what it does. Every pitch, every moment, everything that moves on the ballpark, velocity of the ball, the movement of the ball, the release point of each pitcher, they have a general accounting super value system of some kind, the spin, how many times does the ball spin with a curveball and a slider, and location. Well, I got news for you. Nobody spins the ball twice in a row the same way. It just doesn't happen. You might do it once out of five, once out of four. We've all played with that. Pitchers play with that stuff all the time. They may think we're just a dumb schmo that goes out there every 3, 4, 5, 6 days and just we hope we got good stuff. We know if we got good stuff or bad stuff when we go to the mound. But the bottom line is too many people getting too much credit for this. And the commissioner, who I think could be a good commissioner eventually, all of a sudden they're calling him a visionary. Why? Because you can now take the batter and put him at first base without having to throw four balls?
I like that. I mean, I don't mind that at all. Yeah.
Why do you like it? You know, the average 6 or 7 times a year, a ball is tossed away with an intentional walk. 6 or 7 times.
Well, let's get back
now, but boy, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Yeah. Are you going to take it to where the minor leagues have taken it now? An extra inning ball game, the first hitter up with the visiting team goes to second base. Nobody out.
Yeah.
Now, you want that? I don't either.
So let's go back to your original point.
Let's not go crazy. Once they reduce the mound, they put the pitcher in harm's way, and I think everybody would agree we had more pitchers hurt, more arm problems since they reduced the size of the mound.
Your buddy Lolich is fond of talking about that, and I'm sure everybody would love to hear how you feel about it. He says that guys don't pitch enough anymore.
They don't.
They don't pitch enough. What was the most innings you ever worked in a season in your career?
340.
340 innings. That's ridiculous nowadays, man. What are you kidding me?
240 is tops. Yeah, right. 50% more.
Yeah. But that's the way the game was. It's a whole different generational game now. Yeah. I mean,
I'm going to give Lou Boudreau credit well deserved. He saw that there are finer ways to analyze the game than the standard stuff we had, which was the second baseman plays here, the shortstop plays there, and it's RBIs, hits, and home runs, which are very minimal efforts of a player's productivity. So bringing mathematics into it and parts of runs, the OPS, how a run is broken down into individual bases, how you get there, all the tendencies. And by the way, each team has different algorithms.
Yes.
Each team has different video. When Verlander went to the Astros, they discovered something with their video analysis that the Tigers hadn't. He changed some release point or something in his delivery, and it made him unhittable the rest of the way. So you can't... Verlander.
Yeah,
and so you can't remove the science from the game and the mathematics from the game.
Now how about this explanation for Verlander? He had such a horseshit time there for a while with the ball club this past, before he got traded. He didn't pitch as much. He was well-rested by the time he went to Houston. And how about just that he got well-rested and all of a sudden something returned, namely thought process, throwing the fastball on the first pitch, getting ahead of hitters. All of a sudden, he was doing something he hadn't done all year. He was trying to get ahead with a curveball all the time, trying to get ahead with a slider. That's not the way you pitch, not good pitchers.
Well, I think he also developed another pitch. I mean, he had not only a great curveball, he had a wipeout slider. And then he said, are you throwing a cutter now? Verlander said, no, I'm not throwing a cutter. And they said, yeah, you actually are. So he developed that pitch.
He wasn't throwing a cutter.
JV says, well, I'm experimenting with it and everything like that, but I wouldn't call it a cutter just yet.
The cutter's a natural pitch that will come out of a pitcher's hand, and it's got all to do with pressure points and things like that. There's no way to explain it, by the way. There is no way, because, again, like spinning the ball the same way five times in a row, you can't throw that cutter five times in a row to do the same thing. And half the time, those cutters back up.
Yeah.
Yes?
There's one guy who only threw a cut fastball.
Your relief pitcher.
Mariano Rivera.
Yeah, Rivera.
Greatest relief
yeah.
pitcher. And you knew what it was, and you knew it was coming. You knew where it was going to be. It didn't matter whether you're right-handed or left-handed, and you couldn't hit the
It was not only a slider, but it was a cutter with a slider because the ball dropped about this much. Rivera threw the Johnny Sane slider with tremendous velocity. The difference between him and a lot of other guys who threw the Johnny Sane slider, although most guys who played for Johnny Sane had pretty good success, the difference was the velocity that Rivera had. He really had super velocity. I couldn't believe how hard he could throw the ball and throw that pitch. And apparently it was because he did it all the time, and he figured it out over a period of time.
Quick trivia question. Who invented the slider?
Oh, I know that...
Well, it's just a form of a curveball anyway. So
the first pitcher ever to discover it and use it. Who invented it?
Philadelphia Philly guy?
Red Ruffing.
Red Ruffing?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a long time
is
ago.
Is he Yankee?
Yankee. Sure. Yeah.
Okay, last thing.
I thought it was Robin Roberts.
I read that somewhere recently. So Red Ruffing invented that, huh?
So Bob and I are sitting at the Tiger game on Wednesday. And he says, you know, what's with these guys? Mikey Matuk looked like a decent hitter, and he isn't. And this guy was, why are they all struggling? I said, sometimes I think when you don't have Cabrera in the lineup.
It makes a difference.
It's a contagion that when teams.
It's not a contagion. It's not a contagion. It is a form of intimidation. You do not want Cabrera to come up with two men on base. Never. He makes everybody in front of him a better hitter. Everybody who comes up before him is going to get better pitches to hit. If you're a good hitter, you're going to have a hell of a year. And who we're talking about, who's our switch hitter? The guy that's been hurt now for 11, 12, 13, 14 years.
V-Mart.
Takes 3 weeks off every year. He's became a great hitter, a greater hitter than he was when he got here because of Cabrera. Cabrera intimidates the other side. I mean, if you can't get by Cabrera because you've got two guys on base, you're in a deep, deep
doo-doo. My point to Eli was that we got a lot of kids who look like major league hitters, and all of a sudden, Mikey Matuk can't even hit 200. They sent him out to Toledo for the entire season. James McCann is clearly a 265, 270 guy with 20 homers.
Listen, if he can hit 270... and hit 20 home runs
I think
every
he
year.
Could.
He's a star.
I think he could.
He's a star.
He's a great defensive catcher. He's got a rocket arm. So we've seen a lot of these guys who have regressed, and they're not hitting ahead of Cabrera in any lineup.
Right.
They're the
absolutely.
Same. And I'm just thinking, is the Tigers hitting coach doing a job? I mean, what's wrong with all these guys who have regressed as hitters to the point that they have to be sent out to the minor leagues after they've had success?
And, you know, they take more batting practice now than they've ever thought about taking in their life. They go between innings, they're down there swinging. After the inning, they're down and swinging. They had one a couple of weeks ago. We were down at the ballpark, and who the hell was the center fielder before he got hurt? Oh, gosh, I can't think of his name. But he got so...
Jacoby Jones.
He was into so much talking to the alleged batting coach that they forgot the inning had changed. They were looking for him. He was in the cage.
Yeah.
Okay, before we go, you mentioned Cabrera. And so I'll never forget one of the first times I took Denny into the press box. He started doing a show back in 1990, I think it was. I take him into the press box, and they happened to be playing the Orioles. And who was there sitting one row behind us? But the great, the legendary, one of my boyhood heroes, Frank Robinson. My God, MVP in two leagues. I'm a teenager watching him go from the Reds to the Orioles, triple crown winner, the great Frank Robinson. Denny is just tearing him apart. You couldn't hit me. You sucked. You know, and Robinson's taking it, and he's kind of laughing. So my question is, we talk a lot about Cabrera and Bob Page, our guest here today. Key lines are the greatest right-handed hitter they've ever seen. You saw them all. How does Cabrera rank?
When I talk about K-Line being the best player I ever saw, it's because he did everything in the game. He could run all the around. Bases, home run, all around. Cabrera's probably, I don't know who the other three or four or five are, but Cabrera's in the top four or five.
So,
I don't know who they are.
So
that's
how
good of a hitter
he is. You can compare him with Hank Aaron.
Yeah. I think the guy's still got a chance of hitting 700 home runs.
Yeah.
If he gets healthy and stays healthy and gets serious, if they give him to another ball club that is competitive, he may hit 700
home
runs.
They're not going to take his contract.
But if they take him in Detroit, if they leave him in Detroit, he'll hit another 50, 60 home runs.
Let me ask you a question that I asked Bob Miller, the longtime Philadelphia Phillies pitcher in the 1950s.
Insurance,
off the sand lots
used to be all of our insurance men.
Yeah, because this is a hell of a thing for you guys. You were talking about pitchers and who they get out and who they can't.
Yeah.
I said to Bob one time, I said, how did you do against Aaron and Mays all those years? Yeah, I never had a problem with those guys, really. I had really good success against them. I said, name the one guy that you couldn't get out no matter what you threw him. He said, that's easy. DeFondi.
My Chicago Cub first baseman.
DeFondi. What an obscure player.
So a guy you never could get out. Never, you couldn't get him out.
That was one of my idols. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Chicago.
Who are you talking about?
DeFondi.
DeFondi.
One of my idols. Him and Phil Cabaretta.
I know that, but you didn't play against DeFondi.
Gene Baker, Ernie Banks.
Of course.
Handsome Jackson.
Of course. Randy Jackson,
Harry
third baseman.
Harry Cheedy. I can name the whole club.
Harry Cheedy.
Played for the Mets at the end of his career.
Harry Cheedy played for the Tigers when I was a boy growing
Harry
up.
Cheedy was a war hero. People don't know much about him either.
Yeah, I knew
somebody should have wrote a book about the things that he experienced in World War II.
So anyway, to get back to the point, name the guy that you just couldn't get out no matter what you did.
Me?
Yes, you.
There's only one guy I had any problems with, and I got him out probably 50%, a little bit better than that, I hope. Boog Powell.
Yeah, Eli said that.
I just made mistakes. Yeah. I made mistakes, and the harder I tried, the more I threw the ball down the middle.
Well, you weren't alone.
And the biggest play of 1968 for me was I got the bases loaded, first inning. First and second, third inning maybe. But bases are loaded, nobody out. Powell's the hitter, and out walks Freehand. Freehand says to me, how do you want to pitch him? I said, Jesus, it's been 8 years. I haven't pitched him right yet. Have you got any ideas? I said, I'd love to hear something right now. He says, don't look now. Here comes Mayo. So Mayo comes out to the mound, and he says, what in the hell is going on out here? For Christ's sake, you're going to drive me to drink the way you're pitching today.
Driving to drink more, actually.
Well, yeah, I know. And he talks some more. And finally, he turns to Freehand. He says, Bill, he's behind me, Mayo. He's right over here. He says, Bill, how's his stuff today? How's Denny's stuff today? He's how the goddamn would I know? I haven't caught a goddamn pitch yet.
Didn't hit another triple play after that, though, right?
And then the next pitch, fastball right down the middle, triple play.
Right.
It almost took off my manhood.
Anyway, Enjoy the show today, fellas. This is our third No Filter. Look for it on my website, the No Filter. That's where you're going to find it. And going to put it up on Denny's, too. And, Bob, thanks a lot for joining us. Bob Page, our special guest. And we'll see you next time.
Good to see you, big boy.
No Filter. Thanks for listening.